Tony Rizzulli, we have to end it there. I thank you so much for joining us. He joined us from Najaf, Iraq. That does it for our show. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. It's just about 8 o'clock. Please stay tuned for Positively Revolting Talk Radio.
Tune in to KBOO for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KBOO will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
In 2011, Troy Davis was executed by the state of Georgia despite a compelling case of innocence. This sparked a global movement to end the death penalty. Hear a firsthand account of his story and readings from the book I Am Troy Davis on Prison Pipeline, June 16th at 6:30 p.m.
This Monday at 10:15 a.m. on Locust Focus, Andrew Kimbrell of the Center for Food Safety on the dangers of genetically engineered food.
We're at peak herbicides. We don't have any really new ones. So we're going from Roundup, which is, you know, wide spectrum and not considered that harmful, to more harmful, more toxic herbicides, 2,4-D, and then dicamba. And that'll all be stacked together. So you'll have corn and soy that will be resistant to Roundup, 2,4-D, and dicamba, over 50% of our farmland. Imagine that toxic load. That is the nightmare future that these chemical companies have for us.
That's this Monday at 10:15 on Locust Focus on KBOO Portland.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogring, and I am hosting Positively Revolting today while Ani and Lynn are away on long-deserved vacation. And first, I'd like to make one little announcement. There is a labor action today. There is a group of, they belong to the industrial workers of the world, and they are sort of the campaign workers, you know, people who go canvassing. And there's a labor dispute with the hemp organization. And the workers are claiming that they have been not been getting their paychecks that are all lawfully owed them. So they are protesting today at 10 o'clock, and it'll begin at the office of the IWW at 2249 East Burnside. That's 2249 East Burnside at 10 a.m. And maybe from there they will go on to wherever the headquarters of the campaign organization is. But that's the place to start. 2249 East Burnside at 10 a.m. And you can find out more by calling 503-235-4606. And I think I will leave this later on. I will leave this to the receptionist in case anybody wants to find out more. Also, last week on Fight the Empire, we talked about Ukraine. And I made a remark that that Ukrainians were mainly Catholics. And a listener called in. We didn't talk on the air, but he raised the question that actually Ukrainians are not Catholics. So I said I would do some a little more research on that. And here's what I found out, that actually there are, in Ukraine, there are about three Orthodox churches and two Catholic churches. Now, the main Orthodox church is the Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, and that is the main one. And then there's also an Orthodox Church of the Kiev Patriarchy, or Patriarchate, I guess is how it's pronounced. And then there is a smaller Orthodox Church that is more or less independent, I think. So there's three Orthodox churches, but they are based mainly among the Russian-speaking people of Ukraine, of Eastern Ukraine. And this is sort of part of the divide in that nation state. You have two nations sort of sharing one state. Also, there are two Catholic churches. There is a regular Roman Catholic Church, and then there is the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, which sort of has its allegiance to the Church of Rome. And they are based mainly in Western Ukraine, which is sort of where the real Ukrainians, but the non-Russian speaking Ukrainians are in the western part of that state. And they are the Greek Catholic Church is very strong in supporting this revolt in Kiev that installed this new government. So in a way, it's a very complicated situation. There are Orthodox churches in Ukraine, and they sort of represent more or less the Russian-speaking people. And although there is one that has a archbishop in Kiev, and then there are the two Catholic churches. So that's what I could find out about the churches of Ukraine. Okay, now we're going to go on to what is happening in Iraq. This happened really very, very quickly, and for people who are listening to Democracy Now!, a very important development was that Ayatollah Sistani sort of issued this call to arms, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards said, I think they might actually have troops in Iraq, or they said they would. President Rouhani promised to help the government of Iraq. And meanwhile, this ISIS, it stands for Islamic State of Iraq and Sham. Now, Sham is the Arabic word, includes Syria and Lebanon, although you could also say it's the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And then other people call it the Islamic State of Iraq there's a word for the sort of the general area of the, including Lebanon and Syria. So anyway, but we'll call it ISIS. And then they've been taking over much of western and northern Iraq, not the far northern Kurdish part, but they have captured helicopters and Humvees and cargo planes. And I was told by an Iraqi friend that apparently 500 brand new trucks had arrived. Brand new, not even license plates on them. You know, these are pickup trucks. I believe the Toyotas with machine guns mounted on the back. They seem to be using these all over the world now. And this sort of, where did these come from? Well, we're thinking maybe they came from Saudi Arabia or Qatar. And there's also there are some people who are saying that this is not just a sectarian struggle in Iraq. It's sort of a Saudi war on Iran, because the government of al-Maliki, who actually has been elected, he may be a pretty overbearing, despotic person, but he was elected, and I guess he's up for re-election sometime soon. But he is a Shia, and he is more or less allied with Iran. And rebels, this ISIS group, is a Sunni group. They are actually, from what I understand, they were once part of al-Qaeda, but they were kicked out because al-Qaeda found them too extreme. And we might go into how did this all start? I mean, this happened all of a sudden, this group burst on the scene. And but there's indications that that this thing has been brewing for a long time and planned for a long time. It takes a while to ship 500 brand new trucks there, and you know, and all that kind of stuff. And so this has been going on some time, and it's to say where something begins. It's like coming into a movie. You know, you can come in at different parts of the movie and try and make sense out of what is going on. But to me, the movie kind of, at least this chapter of the movie, begins around 1919, after World War One, when the victorious Allies decided what to do with the old Ottoman Empire, which includes includes just about all the Middle East and parts of North Africa. And they basically carved it up. England and France carved it up. France got Syria and Lebanon, and England got Jordan, which is called Transjordan in those days, including Palestine, and Iraq. And they were supposedly they were considered mandates that England and France were supposed to prepare these nations for self-government and democracy and all that. Well, England, so it was this large, this huge carving up of the Ottoman Empire, and part of that included Britain getting the mandate for Palestine, and then you get the Balfour Declaration, which was supposed to see it as a future homeland for Jewish people. And in Iraq, they took over there, and they discovered oil. All of a sudden, people were realizing what a valuable commodity oil was, and at one point, England named a king of Iraq, and they were fighting rebels then back in the 20s. I believe they had an air war back in 1922 or something, and the first use of poison gas that we know of was the Brits dropping it on Iraqi rebels, I think around 1922. What happened then was that well, this king ruled right up into the 50s when he was overthrown. And Iraq, the leader of the group that overthrew the king was a man named Abdel Karim Qasem. And some people think that he was the best leader that Iraq has ever had, at least since the end of World War One. And before that, there really was no Iraq because it was part of the Ottoman Empire. Well, the U.S. decided that they did not like Abdel Karim Qasem. They thought he was too willing to coexist with the Soviet Union. And so in 1959, the CIA hired a young street thug named Saddam Hussein to help assassinate Qasem. And Saddam Hussein, I believe, was about 22 at the time. And this is from an article by a reporter named Richard Sale for United Press International. And you can look it up. I think Richard Sale is still around, still writing stories. And according to him, the CIA handler for Saddam Hussein was a Baghdad dentist. And they set him up in an apartment on this street where Karim Qasem had his office. And it was Saddam Hussein and one or two other shooters. And I believe this is in 1959. And they killed his chauffeur, and I believe they wounded Qasem. And Saddam Hussein was hit by stray shots also. And he escaped to Cairo, where he lived until for a few years, until there was an overthrow of Qasem in 1963. And I think that he was actually executed on live TV. And so the Ba'ath Party took over. Saddam was not the official president. He was sort of the power behind the scenes. And apparently what happened then was that the CIA gave their hireling a sort of a hit list of leftists to get rid of, which he did. So the U.S., they used Saddam Hussein not only to overthrow Karim Qasem, also to kill leftists, and then later they used Saddam Hussein to fight a war against Iran, and where poison gas was used. So when people say that, well, at least we overthrew Saddam Hussein, got rid of that thug, well, you have to realize that we helped put that thug in power in the first place. So that is some background of what's going on there in Iraq now. If people want to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. Do we have any callers? Oh, you, Edie on the line. Hey, good morning, Edie.
No.
Hello.
Excellent. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
That was an excellent, an accurate summary, and I think it could be very helpful. I wish more people knew what you said. One of the things I did want to correct, though, mm-hmm. is the assumptions about religion in Ukraine or anywhere.
Okay.
You might be correct about official churches mm-hmm. that you can find out about. That does not represent the people who call themselves Christians and are identified by their neighbors as Christians.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of people in the Ukraine who identify as Christians have been very persecuted and do not have edifices and do not have official representation. Have been sent to Siberia, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And are the majority of, and are represented by the majority of people who have become refugees. And they are Protestant Christians. A lot of them are Baptists and, I had the list in my mind, but now I'm forgetting.
Oh, the old believers?
Baptist, Pentecostal, groups like that.
Mm-hmm.
I have on either side of my little apartment, I have six different families, six different, apartment units that are Ukrainian.
Mm-hmm.
And each of them, who are in their late 80s or so, their fathers were sent to Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
One little Olga outside my kitchen window in her late 80s, at age 8, had to leave school because she was a Christian. So they thought she was like the horrid American terrorists that are always trying to, bomb their country off the planet. And so she had to go home and work as a farmer. A peasant farmer in Ukraine works extremely hard as mm-hmm. a grown man. She was a child, having to do this all the time, and even having food that she'd serve other people at weddings, she wasn't allowed to eat any herself.
Hmm.
So the majority of these, you have to be recognized, who are practicing and are devoutly self-identifying as Christians, are not associated with the official accepted institutions that are on the surface.
Do you have any idea how many Protestants there are in Ukraine? I mean, what percentage of the population they are? Or are they?
Well, there are tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be careful. Who counts and who documents? And what are the costs and the benefits of it? There are sometimes churches want to claim they have numbers that they don't really have. And there are sometimes people who are really devout but don't want, to have their businesses stolen from them and their children stolen from them. So, certainly certainly when you look at the number of Bibles that go in, when you look at the numbers of people who are related folks, the folks who are kind of doing radio programs, church-related, when you're looking at the sheer numbers of people who are in Southeast Portland alone and who are still sending money back to their Christian folks back there, it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, but they're more like the traditional first 400 years of the Christian church. They don't have edifices. They don't have, well, they may have a hierarchy, but mm-hmm. early Christianity didn't have hierarchy, didn't have edifices, didn't have government status.
Mm-hmm. Does this include the old believers?
Old believers is just a small part. That's mm-hmm. just a small part.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting. I've been trying to track this down, and I've been doing some research, and as far as I can tell, there are these three Orthodox churches, and the main one seems to be under the Patriarch of Moscow, and there are two Catholic churches, and there are
yeah.
and then there are various Protestant groups. It'd be interesting to get some kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, those are the official ones that are
mm-hmm.
easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, when you talked about numbers of people, it's completely different.
Kind of unknown, I guess.
Well, I mean, even if you wanted to just look at the sheer numbers of people that have been taken to Siberia because of religion.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that was that was under the Soviets, and that ended in 1989.
There's still the dispersal of Christian families. So uh-huh. anyway, I don't know some official. Things that I can trust, but I can tell you that the official surface numbers that you've been looking at, though accurate for what you're doing, should not be generalized, assuming that that means the actual...
Well, we can always find out more. Thanks for the information. Got a couple more
and
callers.
Thank you for your overview.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got a couple more callers on the line. Somebody's next. LJ is on the line. Good morning, LJ. I don't hear LJ. Mm-hmm. Whoops. LJ, are you there? Whoops. Dial tone. Sean is on the line. Good morning, Sean.
Hi, good morning, Bear. Hey, so a great overview on our history. Definitely not the first time I've heard it, but it was great to hear it again. And I just want to say a great big, basically, yawn in regards to the question of who is maybe behind this all of a sudden out of the blue insurgency in Iraq. And I would just say, ironically, based upon the history you just gave, I would almost be certain that definitely the U.S. is behind it. Because if the Saudis are behind it, and the U.S.'s long connection with the Saudis, and the cost that's involved in brand new machinery and guns and ammunition and so forth left behind, I don't know. It just reeks because, you know, Democracy Now, which was just on before you,
mm-hmm.
You know, she was interviewing that fellow from Iraq.
Right. Uh-huh.
And, of course, the thing that he was talking about was, of course, as soon as they came in and invaded in 2003, what it's done ever since is create divisions.
Of course, yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And the whole thing is divide and conquer, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been told by Iraqi friends that this Sunni-Shia divide is sort of, it was not a big deal until it was made a big deal.
Absolutely. It's not like Iraq, just like any place, would mm-hmm. have its problems under any form of government.
Mm-hmm.
But it became huge after they took Saddam out. And, of course, that was
mm-hmm.
one of the main things in order to be able to control the resources. And let's not forget that Maliki is basically the U.S. government. He was the puppet put in as the government.
Well, this is the thing. You see, okay, the U.S. helped install him. They thought he was the best of a bad lot from their point of view. But at the same time, it's like the Saudis who are trying to overthrow them. And the impression I get is that the U.S.-Saudi connection is not as close as it used to be. that the Saudis are kind of going off on their own, and that they are actually, in some ways, they're at cross purposes with the U.S. I know for one thing is interesting is that the Saudis are selling quite a lot of oil to China these days.
And, right, but, you know, when it comes, when you look deeper at this, at these issues, and you also look at the history, these connections between all these parties show that at one time they're friends, other times they're enemies,
mm-hmm.
then they're back to friends,
That's
they're
true.
Back to enemies.
Sure.
And there's the official line and there's the unofficial line.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they want to look like they're at odds, but when it comes down to it, behind the scenes, they are fully supporting each other in whatever task in order to benefit their interests.
Well, it's like, you know, Iraq was sort of patched together after World War One out of several provinces of the Ottoman Empire. And so you have, and now apparently it seems to be breaking apart into those provinces. One thing I forgot to mention before was that originally in the peace talks after World War One, there was supposed to be a Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that... you know, the Ottoman rulers were overthrown, but there was this General Mustafa Kemal Ataturk who he put up a big protest about Kurdistan, and so he persuaded the Allies to forget about the Kurds, and so there they were. They're like a nation without a state. They existed in five different countries. They were in Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq, and four countries. And so now they are. It's not legally a state yet, but they do have their own area, and they seem to be a de facto state. So,
yeah, and have been used by different parties over
the decades.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
You know, under the British, under the U.S., under the Turks, fighting the Russians with the help of the U.S., but then, of course, by Bush Sr., who just left them hanging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, that's why I start off with a big yawn, because when it comes right down to it, I would bet you anything that the U.S. is behind this. These kinds of things don't just all of a sudden show up without some longer-term planning and a hell of a lot of financial investment.
I'm sure,
and, of course, training by intelligence agencies.
But that could have been provided by the Saudis, too. But I mean,
but I think with connections by the U.S., because ultimately it is about dividing and balkanizing that country. And, of course, the resources are more in the north. So it's just, to me, it reeks. And
well,
you know, the fact that all of a sudden just, you got to remember, a year ago there was threat that there might be a war with Iran over the nuclear issue, and now, of course, they're more than willing to work with Iran to fight with this, but it's not really to go against ISIS or specifically the Saudis. It's more to benefit all parties, because historically they have all worked together, and that's about controlling the resources in that region.
Well, that is true. Yeah, it's all about oil. But you think that you think the U.S. wants to get rid of al-Maliki and install this this sort of Islamic state? I mean, I can see Saudi Arabia would like to do that.
Well, no, not necessarily, because, I mean, obviously they're coming in and threatening Maliki, right?
Okay, like a protection racket then.
But the U.S. is saying, we will do anything to in this now this new issue to support Maliki to fight this.
Right. So basically, we're selling protection to Maliki.
Right. And is this
okay?
Is this Iraq? I can't remember the fellow who was just on Democracy Now, but was just pointed out again. We built the largest embassy in the world.
That's true.
In Iraq, employing over 5,000 people, along with 10,000 other troops, and of course, most of them are military contractors. And they are there specifically to protect the U.S. interest of resources, not on just behalf of the U.S., but also the people that they deliver and support of that. And ultimately, you know, any kind of war, no matter what, it's all about creating a catastrophe in order to divide people to be able to control the research.
That could be. Well, that's certainly a live theory. I mean, that's is really possible. I think it's also, you know, I haven't made up my mind. Maybe maybe the U.S. was caught by surprise, or maybe not. But
well, it's laughable in a very sad way because, again, you know, when you look at the history and you see it going back and forth, to me, it just seems so obvious that it's ridiculous.
Well, it's not that. It's just there's these different options here. And started one thing, you know, some people think that is that by sort of breaking up the whole region and creating chaos and make it easier to bring back the oil. And I'm not so sure about that. I don't think, you know, if you have a region where you have nations broken up into warring little factions, it may... I don't see how that makes it easier to get the oil out of there. I really don't. But
well, they seem to be doing it. But the thing is, they seem to be doing it one way or another. And I, you know, I also go back to, well, I mean, there's just many, many books, of course. You know, Chalmers Johnson's The Sorrow of Empire, you know, The Shock Doctrine, so forth. I mean, these are the very kinds of things that they talk about that ultimately... it's during the chaos that they are able to steal the resources. They are able to use it, and they're doing it. You know, whether it's the Chinese, the U.S., you know, the U.S. is now involvement and the larger involvement in Africa, and so not to go on, but just it, they are able to do it, and if they can create the chaos which keeps people distracted and weakens, I mean, that's the whole thing. It's almost like, the bigger it gets and the smaller these factions become, it's just like you mentioned yourself. Where did these people, where did ISIS all of a sudden come from?
Well, they came out of Al-Qaeda. Where did Al-Qaeda come from? It came from Brzezinski's wonderful idea to get the Soviet Union to get stuck with a war in Afghanistan. That was sort of where Al-Qaeda originated.
Right, but at the, and at the same time, you have viewpoints that there never really truly was an Al-Qaeda. Where does that come from? You know, Adam Curtis, the reporter from England, who did not only two fantastic documentaries, not only on called The Century of Self, which was incredible, but also The War of Fear. And the War of Fear generated by the media and governments start creating these so-called factions and giving them a name, but do they actually exist?
Well, they exist as a, I don't know, I've heard they exist as a kind of like a brand or a franchise. I mean, any, you know, it doesn't take much to organize a group of terrorists, and you have to have some dedicated people and a few weapons, and then go on from there, you know.
And 500 new trucks with machine guns.
Well, I mean, now they apparently came from Saudi Arabia, I guess. Well, this is something we got to keep looking at.
I'll let you leave for another caller, but thanks.
Yeah, as long as one of recommended reading material, I would check out the articles by Pepe Escobar. I read him in the Asia Times, but he also writes for Russia Today and other places. So he's been writing a lot about what he calls Pipelinistan. And so we've had him as a guest on Fight the Empire several times. So anyway, thanks for your call. Now we have... you ever track down LJ? LJ, there you are. Are you there? LJ is hiding.
Hi, I'm right here.
There you are.
Here I am.
Yes, how you doing?
I'm great, Pear. I'm great. Okay, just a couple of quick points. Can we establish pretty clearly that we were lied into this war to begin with?
Oh, yes.
This whole... Our Iraq thing was a lie perpetrated by the Cheney Bush Rumsfeld cabal.
So
we have to make that real clear. Now, did you want to touch on Paul Bremer's role in rewriting the Iraqi constitution?
Well, we could. That's kind of like, you know, it's very interesting what he did. It's not crucial to what's going on now,
but it basically lays the foundation for what's happening now.
It does, yes. He disbanded the Iraqi army, for one thing.
And then he basically rewrote the Constitution, where the American corporations suck out all of the money and leave the Iraqis with almost nothing.
That's true. Yes, I mean, yep. I mean the U.S. has really bungled the whole thing from any point of view. You know.
Oh, they sure did. And and just one more quick point, and I'll get off the air.
Mm-hmm.
The Joseph Wilson Valerie Plame debacle.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Joe Wilson was sent by Cheney to concoct some story about yellow cake uranium that he wouldn't go along with, and all of a sudden his wife Valerie Plame, who's a CIA operative, gets outed.
That's right. Yes. Uh huh.
So anyway, that's really all I've had to say.
It's well.
And to sum it up, it's. This whole thing is simply the chickens coming home to roost.
Well, I think that is true. Yes, indeed. All these crimes are going all the way back to World War I are just kind of exploding, you know. And it's where this ends, I don't know. Anyway, thanks for calling. One thing I'd like to bring up before we get our next caller. This is an article I read in the National Journal. Headline is, Congress's Iraq vets helplessly watch their gains lost. And these were some three Republican congressmen who served in Iraq. One is Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, and he's quoted as, this is his, what he said, going out across a desert, I remember the feelings that you have, wondering if you're going to make it out alive, Perry said. Right now, I wonder what that was all about. What was the point of all that? So it's like these Iraq vets in Congress are, questioning, was that war worth their involvement? And as you know, you think of all the soldiers who were killed and wounded and lives destroyed, and plus the Iraqis, and did these guys fight in vain? I think that's be interesting. If there are any Iraq vets out there who would like to contribute to this, give us a call at 503-231-8187. If you were in Iraq, do you think it was worth it or not? Coming up on KBOO, at 9, a political perspectives, a set of talks from the recent conference, yet again as captives, mass incarceration in the U.S. and Palestine. And this features Angela Davis and Noura Erekat. At 10, we have Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, Chris Andre. 10:15 is Flashpoint, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Rabia Yemen hosts a digital divide analyzing how to use science, medicine, and technology to benefit society and keep it from harming us. So thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. And if you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. So, having said that, do we have another caller? Thomas on the line. Good morning.
Yeah, great thumbnail sketch of some of the history of intervention there, and also trenchant comments by the callers for sure. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think that, we really have to step back and look at this within the context of the idea of a big proxy war going on in the larger context of the United States and Israel and its Western European allies, along with primarily Saudi Arabia, but also other Gulf and Emirate states, wanting to maintain a certain hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even just for preferential access to whatever raw materials exist in these areas. It's to block access from others.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, if you look at the situation with Iraq being a statistically, it's a Shiite majority country. And of course, Saddam Hussein was a part of the Sunni minority, backed by the United States for all those years. And of course, all of that—that's a recipe for instability to begin with. And now, of course, Mr. al-Maliki, which in his government, which was largely a puppet and as a of the United States, and the previous caller pointed out, indeed, Mr. Paul Bremer and others were right involved with writing a dream, a corporate dream, sort of a privatization model constitution for the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this translates directly into the fact that all of these Iraqi soldiers deserted so fast their post. I mean, it's no different than the psychology in a place like South Vietnam, I would say, during the Vietnam War, where you have people that essentially know at one level or another that really their government is a fraud, and it doesn't really have anything to offer them. So, you know, there's the litmus for the morale. And I think, you know, whether the Obama regime and others plan specifically this particular action, or whether this is more of a unilateral Saudi sort of a backing of this, I think, you know, we may not know that right now, but I think beyond everything, we can say, well, what does the United States and Saudi Arabia not want?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the number one thing that they do not want is any scenario to unfold which gives Iran more regional power or clout in the situation. And of course, you know, thinking, of course, Iran being a dominant Shiite country, and already with the U.S. Recent U.S. Phase pullout of most troops from Iraq, there was all sorts of discussion, as you know, about, well, did the United States really, quote unquote, win anything? If anything, they're closer to Iran and so forth. And I think the last thing that the Saudis, who are, of course, the arch enemies and nemesis of Iran, and the United States and Israel, want is for a situation to emerge wherein all of a sudden Iran's going to come in like the Lone Ranger and bring in their elite forces and, you know, and legitimacy and to back up a government, to instability. So, you know, I think that even this part of these pronouncements that today in the last 24 hours of Obama talking about finally giving some military support may be at least partly in response to the dawning realization that Iran is going to come out smelling like a rose. And of course, you know, I think the caller's comments about balkanization and fractionalization being a key goal, I think that's true. If you can't get the government that you want that's going to play ball, the next best thing, and I say best thing from a very dark, psychopathic devil's advocate perspective, is you want countries weak and broken up, because not only does this keep them from forming regional alliances and blocks which are outside of the U.S. Circle, but it also creates a pretext for intervention. Let's not overlook the role of the U.S. military-industrial complex, which is really, in the United States, you know, for, set aside, you know, any thinking of security or any chimera thought of that, the big victory has really been the United States military-industrial complex. And you know, and whether we're sending $60 billion worth of high-tech aircraft to Saudi Arabia as the recent largest arms deal in the history of the planet, which was brokered by dear Hillary Clinton a couple of years ago to Saudi Arabia, which of course, you know, or whether it's continually vomiting and flooding weapons into a so-called expanded NATO, you know, these people have power, and these people are lobbyists, and so these are the big winners. So, you know, the death and the suffering and the hurt of the poor people in Syria or the people in Iraq, I mean, this is all just collateral damage.
Well,
so, yeah, anyway, so I really think that, you know, the cynical game is with people like al-Maliki and Mr. Karzai in Afghanistan, we use them as long as we need them, and then we throw them away. And I think with al-Maliki, I wouldn't be surprised if back-channel the Obama administration is setting up a quid pro quo. Hey, look, we're going to do some airstrikes for you, but we want something in return.
Because, that could be, yeah.
Right, because we know that a lot of the oil concessions did not go the way the United States, you know, the bipartisan neocon regime the United States wanted, which was for United States to have and Western countries to have most of the preferential oil.
The whole thing. It didn't work out that way. And even Saudi Arabia is selling a lot of its oil to China. And apparently they're not selling it in dollars either. You have the whole thing when I mentioned Pepe Escobar and his writing about Pipelinistan. You have this whole Asian continent is sort of they can move oil around by pipeline. They don't have to put it on tankers or freeze natural gas in a liquefied natural gas. And so Russia and China just signed this $400 billion trade pact, and
and this is all foreseeable. I mean, mm-hmm. You think about even going back 15 years ago, you realize with the Clinton administration and the NATO aggression against Yugoslavia, and the fact that NATO was used for its offensive purpose for the first time in its history, violating mm-hmm. its own charter. I mean, this set a horrible precedent, and this recent talk by Obama. This neocon, and incidentally, Obama, one of his key advisors is none other than Zbigniew Brzezinski.
That's true. But the same.
Who was behind the CIA plan of Operation Cyclone that you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. which was to arm and train these fanatical elements. The United States mm-hmm. has been the single, in Saudi Arabia, have been the single largest. Underwriters and supporters of Islamic fanaticism in the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. And there again, the cynical strategy of divide and conquer. And of course, right in the middle, there again, Saudi Arabia, the Bank of Credit and Commerce mm-hmm. International, a giant money laundering bank to fund a bunch of religious extremists and drug people. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it really is the chickens coming home to roost in the sense of global security. But there again, as long as you can keep things broken up, as long as your real or imagined global competitors aren't able to create deals, fair or otherwise, with oil producing regions mm-hmm. and regions that have wealthy, I hate to say it, but this is this.
I don't think the strategy is working though. I think it's breaking apart. Already Obama is being criticized by the neocons, and it's like. I just do not see it working. I think the wheels are coming off the empire's wagon,
I think you're right, but I think mm-hmm. they still have a lot of power.
They do, yep.
But, and unfortunately, the thing is, Per, the thing that really scares me is that there's about 10 different ways that even legitimate help from Iran to stabilize this crisis can be played into a pretext for even a more militant stance against Iran. And that's what that's what I'm really fearing right now.
Well, I think the American people are really fed up with war. That's why Obama never did bomb Syria, And Putin offered him a way out, and the neocons never forgave him for that. So it's a strange situation. I don't know where it's leading to, but anyway. Thanks for your call, though.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man.
Do we have another caller? Justin's on the line. Good morning, Justin. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
Good. I want to thank you for the short history lesson. And two things. The congressman from Pennsylvania who served in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
His question of him questioning basically what we accomplished there
mm-hmm.
And meeting our goals, I thought that was already decided with the whole not finding WMDs.
Well, that was the excuse,
right? Isn't that why we went there?
I think we went there to get some lucrative oil contracts, and we didn't quite get them. And with just sort of the excuse of the WMDs, but Iraq started pumping oil again, but a lot of that oil was sold to China and other countries. And mm-hmm. from what I understand, the Western oil companies did not get what they were hoping to get, which was sort of a kind of a profit-sharing thing. In other words, they were sort of hired there to do specific tasks, and they were given, you know, they made money doing that, but they didn't get the control that they were after. But that's mm-hmm. something to check into some more.
Well, you know, I know there was some of that, like in the Kurdistan region, mm-hmm. Hunt Oil out of Texas mm-hmm. Got some extremely lucrative contracts. So mm-hmm. it may not have been exactly what they wanted, but they still came out on top.
Well, they got something. They didn't lose out, but they, you know, China got something too. One interesting thing, I just read that the price of oil now, the price of Brent crude, which is sort of the world benchmark oil, is up to $113 a barrel. The U.S. West Texas Intermediate, which is always a little bit lower, is up to $106 a barrel. So oil is getting more expensive, and depending on how this thing goes, who knows where. I mean, I just read something today that somebody's predicting that oil may get higher than it's ever been. It reached a high of $147 a barrel back in 2008, and it may go beyond that, according to some people. We'll just have to see.
Yeah, I agree with the previous callers. I would say that it's Saudi and America working in collusion, obviously, for mm-hmm. what I would assume would be the best outcome for everyone. But
well,
I'm sure that's what they're working on behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm. I think that alliance is kind of falling apart a little. That alliance is not as strong as it used to be. You know, I mean,
good,
it's,
I hope so.
Well, yeah. I would like to see the end of the Saudi crime family myself, but
I completely agree.
Who knows? That could happen too.
There's one other thing that kind of inspired on the history lesson that you went off earlier. It seems that most Americans, their history of American involvement in Iran starts in 1979.
Oh, wow. That's a big mistake. Yes. Okay.
You know, but most people you talk, I feel like the majority of people you talk to, they're not aware of American involvement pre that, and
53.
You know, they use the hostage crisis
as
this huge thing. Mm-hmm. But really, the hostage crisis was just frustrated Iranian students that were tired of America bullying their country around and manipulating it, the internal politics of the country.
Well, in 1953, we overthrew a democratic government in Iran, Mossadegh, and installed the Shah. That was in 1953. And then the Shah was...
The coup actually came out of that embassy as well. So mm-hmm. it was symbolic mm-hmm. when they took it over.
An interesting thing, too, is, you know, when the students took over the embassy and held the hostages, they also liberated a whole lot of secret documents. And apparently they are around. I think you can find them on WikiLeaks or something. These papers, I was always been wondering about this, but these documents do exist, and they can be you can check them out, you know. But
I wasn't aware of that, but that's something mm-hmm. that I'll definitely look into. It sounds mm-hmm. like very, very pertinent information.
There was some guest on Democracy Now! Talked about that at one not too long ago. So, but anyway, it's a very interesting thing to check out. Anyway, thank you for your call.
Thank you. Have a great day, and appreciate the topic.
Yes. Well, this one's not going to end soon. I'm afraid of that. Where to go?
Unfortunately, not.
I don't know. But do we have any more callers? Harry's on the line. Good morning, Harry. I hear a little dog barking. Hello. Are you there?
Okay. Who are you talking, John?
Well, whoever's on the line,
okay, my name is John.
Oh, okay, great.
And, you know, all this political and, you know, speculation and all that, when it comes right down to it, trillions of dollars down the toilet.
That's true, yep.
And I had a perception from, this is kind of a couple years ago, we were borrowing money from China mm-hmm. to pay for this war in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And so there were promises made.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to have to pony up.
That's right. Yeah.
But it kind of ticks me off a little bit because I work for an agency that has retired federal employees. A lot of them are well, retired military.
Uh-huh.
And they're blaming everything on the welfare bitches.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And so when I see this, it's another Vietnam, it's another Korea, and it, you know, I just see this as, you know, the beginning of the end, or the end of the beginning, like Churchill said.
Mm-hmm.
I think the American empire is now being chewed up and spit out.
Yeah, I think so.
And so, you know, people are just going to have to, you know, work smarter, not harder.
Well, all these debts, you know, they either get paid or they get defaulted on, and either way leads to some really serious economic consequences. So,
well, I think what the total price so far has been just in Iraq alone is $6 trillion.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yes. Uh-huh.
I mean, our infrastructure's crap.
That's right. Yes.
Well, that's my own comment. It all comes down to the bottom line: money.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time.
Thanks for your call. Mm-hmm. And no one else yet. Well, still waiting, wondering if any Iraq vets want to call in, and did they feel that their service was worth it? You know, it just it's interesting. President Obama made some statement the other day about you know, just because, you know, this whole hammer and the nail thing, that I think exactly what he said now, that we don't have, just because we have a hammer doesn't mean we have to use it all the time. And it seems to me that we got this hammer, but we can't even pound in a nail straight. We keep bending the nails. So anyway, let's go on to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Earlier today, you were talking about Ukraine.
Uh-huh.
And the borders kind of over the last 100 years kind of shifted after World War One,
mm-hmm.
when Russia, of course, we punished Russia for making a deal with Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So the borders kind of moved east.
Mm-hmm.
But after World War Two, Stalin moved the borders a little more west. So parts of like the western part of Ukraine used to be parts of Poland.
That's right. Yes, or Lithuania. So, before that, Lithuania. I mean, there were different empires ruled Ukraine.
Yeah. So so they're still dealing with that. Oh. Also, Ukraine has a very large Jewish population.
Mm-hmm.
And what I remember during the Soviet era, they had I think it's in Ukraine. It's called the city of Odessa.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah, and that was the only open city in the Soviet Union.
Really? Uh-huh.
And you know, ships can come from all nations used to go there, and they didn't really do anything too much. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in the early 1900s, Odessa Jazz.
Well, you know, a Russian writer named Isaac Babel wrote some very interesting stories about Odessa. It was quite a colorful city, you know, and so if you want to find out more about Odessa, look up Isaac Babel, B-A-B-E-L. He wrote some interesting stories. But we got another caller on the line, so thank you. So who's next? Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say that this is really about endless conquest, really. If
mm-hmm.
you put all the dots together,
mm-hmm.
it's like the conquest never stopped. We fought King George for our freedom just so we could go out and conquer the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think, yeah, that's sort of the, it's very interesting. One of the things in the American Declaration of Independence, one of our complaints against King George was that he inflicted what the colonists called, quote, merciless savages against the colonists. And, you know, colonists wanted to fight the Indians and expand their territory, which they did once they became independent of King George. But I think we're getting near the end of this show. Do we have time for one more caller, another caller on the line? I don't know. No, we don't. Well, I think we will wrap it up. It's been very interesting. This situation is obviously going to keep on going. Where it ends, I really don't know. Amy Goodman said on Democracy Now!, it's very interesting that Iran is getting involved in this. And, you know, it's right next door to them. And Iraq under Saddam Hussein already fought one war against Iran, using poison gas, by the way. And so it seems to me Iran has a very reasonable cause for concern that if these this ISIS group, this Islamic State of Iraq and Sham takes over, it can be very dangerous for everybody, including Iran, including all the neighboring countries. So I don't blame them for getting involved in this. I mean, if we can get involved, you know, on the other side of the world, why can't Iran get involved when it's right next door to them? So I think we're going to end it on that. This has been Positively Revolting. I've been filling in for Ani and Lynn, and I hope they're having a good time in Mexico on vacation. And stay tuned for something good on KBOO, your radio station.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9 a.m. Coming up next, on Political Perspectives, we feature two talks given in April at PeaceWorks 2014, featuring Noura Erekat and Angela Davis. But first, this.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 13th annual Explorando on Saturday, June 14th at Whitaker Ponds Nature Park from 1 to 5 p.m. Explorando will feature live music, folkloric dances, guided canoe trips, hands-on environmental activities by rock climbing wall, and more! Explorando gives people the opportunity to learn about the importance of preserving the nature of the Columbia Slough. Again, that's Explorando, June 14th at Whitaker Ponds Nature Park from 1 to 5 p.m. More information